We are starting a new series today. We just got done here for 3 weeks talking about media, how we kind of live in this very media-driven world, how we live well in it. Today we're going to start a series. We actually started it Friday night. Jerry Woods did the message on Friday night. It's called A Practical Guide for Worshiping a Holy God. And we're going to just walk through Psalm 50. So for the next 3 weeks, what we're going to do is we're just going to take Psalm 50, 5-0, and we're going to walk through it. It kind of divides itself up into three sections, and so that's what we're going to do, and we're going to take the first section today, and we're calling it A Practical Guide to Worshiping a Holy God. And those are worshiping a holy God. Those are very religious type words, and rightfully so. You know, worship, holy God. These are kind of almost words that are shrouded perhaps in mystery or are deep, big words. And that's true. And we want to talk about that, but we want to make it practical as well, because we live in a very ordinary day-to-day world. And so what we're going to talk about is, how can we live in the world we live in? You get up, you go to work, you're doing the laundry, you're just raising your kids, we're just living life in that world. How do we worship a holy God? How do these two things combine? So that's what we're going to do here for the next 3 weeks. And we're going to start today just kind of, before we get into Psalm 50, just kind of chewing a little bit on that word worship. You know, we're commanded to worship God. We should worship God. And that's, you know, sometimes we maybe say, oh, we could worship God, or it would be good to worship God. But we're called to, we're commanded to, you and I should worship God. And in Luke chapter 4, that's what Jesus says. Jesus replied, "It is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." He's quoting the Old Testament there. He's quoting Deuteronomy. One of the Ten Commandments is, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. You shall have no other gods before me. We are commanded, you and I are commanded, to do this thing called worship. Worship God. We're supposed to worship him. And we should worship him only. So God gets my worship and nothing else does. And that's a command that God has given from the beginning, when God began to interact with people. We see it in the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament. It's carried through all the way through the Bible. We see this thing where we're supposed to, we're called to, we should worship God. And yet worship is one of those words that I don't know how much it enters our lexicon, how often we think about that. What do I worship? Do I worship anything? Because again, it's one of those words that's kind of reserved for something else, and it's like grandma's best china. It gets put on the shelf, and maybe once in a while we take it out and we're real careful with it, then we put it back. And yet worship is something that's supposed to happen regularly every day. So what in the world is worship? If we're going to talk about practically worshiping God in the world we live in, it's probably a good idea just to spend a little bit of time talking about what worship is. And there's two primary words in the Bible that get used to do worship. And actually, in this verse, we kind of see both of them. There's a word in the Old Testament primarily that is used that's translated worship, and it literally means to bow down. And it's a external type word. It's an action word. And so it's literally to kneel, to stoop down. And so if you worship, that word literally means you would get down on your knees perhaps. And it speaks primarily of your posture, your action. It's an outward, external thing. So part of worship is this. There's this show, perhaps, this activity, this action that we take that shows submission, that shows I am submitting myself. But it's an external word. It's an action word. It's something that we do. It has to do with our posture, with our activities. That word shows up mostly in the Old Testament, or the Old Testament word that is translated worship primarily has that connotation. In the New Testament, the word that primarily is transferred or translated worship means to revere. And it's more of an internal thing. It's an attitude. It's how do I feel? How do I see myself in relation to the thing that I am worshiping? It's a respect. It's what do I feel about you? It's more emotional. It's internal. And it could be more of a motivational term. The one is what I do. The second one is why I do it. What's driving me to do it? Do I have an internal respect for the person that I am bowing down to, perhaps? Now, in both of those words, it infers the other thing. In other words, in the Old Testament word, it's not just an action, it infers the attitude. In the New Testament word, it's not just the attitude, it infers the action. But they are kind of distinct a little bit. But worship, if we're going to understand worship, it's both. There's an action. I take action. I conduct myself in a certain way. I do certain things because there is an internal drive inside of me that compels me to do it. It's a little bit like, you know, you can open the door for somebody if you're going to the mall this afternoon. And, you know, you're walking in front of some people and you're walking into Shields and you are the first one to the door, you open the door. Well, oftentimes what'll happen? You know, you'll just stop and let that other person walk in. That's an action. I'm just, you know, allowing you to go through. But that person behind me, I have no idea who it is. And so there's nothing really internal that would motivate me to do that other than it's just kind of a nice thing. If that was my mom, perhaps, coming behind me, well, that's different. I want to show my mom honor. I want to show my mom respect. And mom, come on in. You go first. Or my wife or something like that. And so it's both. Do you see that worship, the way we're talking about it here, is two components. It's what's inside of me. Do I have a respect and honor? Am I driven by a reverence? And that internal motivation compels me to act a certain way, to look a certain way, to do certain things, okay? Does that make sense? That's what worship is. That's what we're supposed to do with God. We are commanded to have a certain internal understanding of God. We are commanded to have a certain reverence for God, a respect and honor for God. We're commanded inside of us to see God in a certain way that compels us then to take certain actions, to submit, to bow down, to obey. That's what worship is. I am moved by my understanding and my attitude toward God to act toward God in a certain way. Does that make sense? That's what worship is. That's what we're talking about. And you and I are commanded, we should do that, we should have that attitude, and we should let that attitude compel us regularly. So that's what this whole series is about, learning how to do that in an everyday way. Now, we're taking Psalm 50, and we're going to walk through Psalm 50 to kind of help us understand that a little bit. And Psalm 50 is an interesting psalm. It might challenge a little bit some of our contemporary understandings of what it looks like, what it means to worship. But today what we're going to do is take the first six verses. And it's called the God we worship. We're going to look at who is this God. I'm supposed to worship God. I'm commanded to worship God. All right. Well, let's look at the object of our worship and understand who he is. And so that's what we're going to do today. Take those first six verses and just kind of walk through this a little bit. So if you have a Bible, you can open up to Psalm 50. I would encourage you to spend some time the next 3 weeks reading this psalm. Just let God speak to you in different ways. I'm reading out of the NIV. Sometimes fun to read it out of all kinds of different translations this last week. As I've been studying this, I was reading the King James, the New Living, and one other. Oh, the ESV, English Standard Version. There's all kinds of fun versions out there that will help you to understand. But I'm going to read these first six verses out of the NIV. We're going to talk about them a little bit. Who is this God that we're worshiping? Who is this God that I'm commanded to worship? So here I go. I'm just going to read the first six verses of Psalm 50. The Mighty One, God the Lord, speaks and summons the earth. From the rising of the sun to the place where it sets, From Zion, perfect in beauty, God shines forth. Our God comes, and he will not be silent. A fire devours before him, and around him a tempest rages. He summons the heavens above and the earth that he may judge his people. Gather to me my consecrated ones who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And the heavens proclaim his righteousness, for God himself is judge. All right, let's talk about this a little bit. Who is this God that we're commanded to worship? What do we see here in the first part of Psalm 50? Well, a couple of things. Number one, we see that God is coming. This God is coming. He's coming to us. And the God that's coming is described in this psalm in some different ways. Luke, can you move me ahead a little bit? No, one more. There we go. This God who is coming is described in Psalm 50 in some certain ways. And there's actually three distinct titles given to God. And again, what we're looking at here is, who is this God? Well, right in the very beginning of Psalm 50, it describes God with three different words. And each of those words has a little bit of a different meaning. The first one is El, and it just means mighty. So this powerful God, it really has the connotation of power, strength, might, strong. This powerful God is coming, and it's interesting how often come sounds here, or we see that word. God is coming, he's coming, he's coming, he's coming, this strong, powerful thing. He's powerful, he's coming. I watched the storm last night. If you guys were out, I like thunderstorms, and so I watched it. I can stand on my deck, and I could see to the southwest, and the sky was black, and it was dark, and the lightning was just filling up the sky, and then the thunder would come. And as the storm moved closer, the lightning and the thunder got closer and closer together. And that's kind of the connotation here, that there's this powerful thing. It's strong, and it's coming. You know, my wife thinks I'm crazy. I'll stand outside. And the stronger the storm, the more I want to see it. But that's kind of the connotation here. There's strength, and it's powerful, and it's mighty, and it's beyond me, and it is moving in my direction. Power, might, that's who is coming. The second word is Elohim, and it means God. It's a word that can be described or used to describe lots of gods, like, you know, kings, rulers, things like that. But there's a connotation to it. Elohim means the supreme one, the God among gods, if you will. It's, okay, there's all kinds of rulers, but there's one king. There's all kinds of gods, quote, but this is the supreme God. Above all others, no one is his equal. That's the second distinct word that is used to describe God here. And the third one is Jehovah, the Lord. And it means God is one, or he's complete. He's always been. He's been forever. He will be forever. He needs nothing. He is complete in and of himself. He needs nothing else. And really, that's the word. He's alone. He's eternal. He's complete. He's self-sufficient. That's actually what one of the definitions of that word is. He is self-sufficient. So what do we see here? God is coming. This God that we're supposed to worship, he's coming. And this is a God. He is really God. We use that word so flippantly sometimes. Especially, you know, the Marvel movies have kind of cheapened that word. Now, I'm not telling you shouldn't watch it. But we've kind of, you know, used that word and kind of cheapened it a little bit. This is God. And what that means is he has authority and he has power. He has the right to command and the strength to do it. That's what we're talking about here. That's what these words convey. God, the creator, the ruler, the king who has power and authority is coming. There's no one like him. There's nothing like him. He's alone, he's strong, he's mighty, he's powerful, he's God. That's the first thing we see. God is coming. Here's the second thing we see. This God is speaking. All throughout this first few verses, we see that God is talking. And again, there's all these different words that kind of convey that. But a lot of what God is doing here in these first six verses is he's speaking, he's talking, he's communicating. And lots of these different words, again, in the NIV, it says, you know, God is speaking. Right away, he speaks. And that word literally means to engage. It means to communicate. And it infers he's communicating to a person, not just in general. He's speaking to you. There's an engagement. It's like if you have a conversation out in the foyer, you know, right now I'm speaking and I'm just kind of proclaiming things to lots of different people. That's different if you caught me out in the foyer and you and I are having a conversation. This kind of infers that there's that one-on-one conversation. He's speaking to you. He's speaking to you. It says that he summons. He summons us as he speaks. And that's a word that literally translates into accost. He accosts us. He demands our attention. He confronts us. Listen to me. Come here. It's a command that demands obedience. That's what that word means. He summons you. I am God and I am looking at you and you will pay attention to me. Listen to me. Come here. It's a command. It's a confrontational word. It says that he will not keep silent. And that's an interesting word too, because what it means is I'm going to reveal secrets. There's going to be nothing hidden here. You know, sometimes we have a conversation with people and we know that certain topics are off the table, right? Certain topics are out of bounds. Well, this God says, I'm going to come and I'm going to speak to you and nothing is out of bounds. I know everything and it's all fair game. There will be no secrets. Everything will be revealed. That's literally what it means. He will not keep silent, meaning he will say everything. Nothing will be hidden. Everything will be revealed. And it describes how that's going to happen. It says that he comes like a tempest, and it's a storm, and it rages, and it this storm is coming again. I watched the storm roll in last night. If you've never done that, it's just very instructive, because that's the picture that God uses here to describe how he's speaking. It's this huge thing. When I was sitting downstairs and giving my wife a back rub, and I heard the thunder, and I said, I gotta go, and I ran upstairs. I finished the back rub later, but I heard the thunder, and it stirs us, and that's what it is. This God is thundering. He's thundering. His voice is not just, hey guys, what are you doing? He's thundering. That's how God is speaking. And then he ups the ante a little bit. He says it's rages, that this tempest, this storm is raging, and the term there really means it's violent, it's fearful, it's scary. This God is speaking to you. He's saying everything that he wants to say, and he's saying it powerfully and passionately, and there's a violence and a fear attached to it. That's what these words mean here. That's what God is saying about himself. So God is coming. God is speaking. This God is coming and speaking this way. He's coming to his people. It's interesting here that God is coming this way, not to strangers or enemies. He's not coming to people who hate him and speaking violently and revealing secrets and speaking powerfully. He's not coming with might and power to those who have run away from him. No, he says, gather to me my consecrated ones who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice, his people. In another translation, he says, bring my people to me so that I can speak to them. It's interesting here. We can think, okay, yes, God might speak violently and reveal secrets and come powerfully, but he's going to do that to people who are his enemies, right? Or his strangers. Well, here, no. Here, God specifically singles out and says, I am coming to my people. I'm coming to those who know me. I am coming to those who have made a conscious choice to serve me, to be mine. They've been consecrated, set apart for me. They've chosen to make a covenant with me. They've given something. They've sacrificed. These people have come to me, found me, surrendered to me, those people, my people, and I am coming to them this way. I'm coming to them, my people, powerfully. I'm speaking to them this way. God's coming to his people. And as he comes, the fourth thing we see here, God is coming. God is speaking. He's coming to his people, and he's speaking powerfully, and he's doing it to judge. God is judging. Twice in this six verses, He says, I'm coming to judge, that he may judge his people. And these words mean different things there. That God says he's coming to judge his people. And that first one means to decide or to weigh the evidence. I'm going to look at all the evidence. I'm the one that is going to sort through and say, this is true, this is true, this evidence means something, that evidence doesn't, this is what happened. God says, I'm judging, I'm taking the evidence, and I am looking at it. I'm looking at you, I'm looking at all everything. I'm the judge, I'm the one that's going to decide what's true, what isn't. I'm going to decide what's important and what isn't. I'm going to be the one who looks at the evidence. That's that first word. And then the second one is judge, meaning to sentence. Once I look at the evidence, I'm going to pass a judgment. I'm going to determine guilt or innocent. And I am going to punish or reward. That's what that word means. So God is the judge. He says, I'm coming and I'm speaking. I am summoning you. I'm coming to you forcefully, even fearfully. And what I'm going to do, the point of this is I am judging. I am looking at you. I am gathering evidence. And I'm going to pass judgment. Did you do well? Did you not do well? That's who we're seeing here. That's the God that we're commanded to worship. So if I was going to sum that up in one sentence, I would say this. God is coming to his people as a powerful and fearful judge. When we read Psalm 50, when we look at this psalm, this is what we see. God is coming to his people, to you and I, to the nation of Israel, to his church. He's coming as a powerful and fearful judge. Now, when we say that, sometimes, well, I wonder how many of us think, well, yeah, but is that still what happens? Isn't that like an Old Testament thing? Sure, that happened in the Old Testament, but didn't Jesus change all of that? I mean, now, as the church, as God's chosen people, didn't Jesus take that away, where I no longer have to face God as a judge? Where I no longer have to fear him looking at my life because Christ paid the penalty for my sins. So is this really true still? Or has it changed somehow? Well, that's the way God used to be, sure. But then Jesus came and it all changed. And now God is not that way with me anymore. And it's a fair question. Didn't Jesus take this off the table? Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I want to read a verse here in 2 Corinthians 5. I'm going to start with verse 9. It says this, so we make it our goal to please him. Now, again, this is written to you and I. This is after Jesus. This is written to the church. This is after Christ has died and risen again. This is written by a man who has been saved by faith. And he understands that his sins are paid for. The covenant he made with God was by Christ's sacrifice. Remember we looked at that earlier. My people who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. Well, Paul, the guy that wrote this, did that. He made a covenant with God because of Jesus' sacrifice. I will take the payment he made. And God says that's sufficient. So that he was brought back in. He was consecrated. He was made holy. He was adopted back into God's family. That's Paul. That's the guy that's writing this. He's writing this to people who have done the same thing. To you and I. If you have accepted Christ's payment, you have made a covenant with God by sacrifice. You are now consecrated. You are his holy people. You are his children, his sons and daughters. Because you came to God humbly and said, Christ paid a sacrifice I couldn't make. And God said, yes, and I will accept that. So Paul is writing this to Christians, to saints, to those who are saved. And he says this, we make it our goal to please him, whether we're at home in the body or away from it. Why? For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. We all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ. All, meaning you and I, not people who have rejected Christ, you and I. after we get saved. Once we become God's people, we will still, at some point, appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Why? So that each one of us may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. In other words, what happens? God's people, if I understand this verse correctly, God's people will face God the judge. But to understand this, we have to know the difference between consequences and condemnation. We have to understand something, because it also says, the same man who wrote this said there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. That's in Romans chapter 8, verse 1. And if you read Romans 7, Paul is looking at himself and saying very clearly, I am a mess. I have failed. The things I want to do, I can't do. The things I don't want to do, I keep doing them. I'm looking at my life, says Paul, and I know I don't measure up because I struggle in this world. But he says, thanks be to God, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And it's the difference. He understood that he will never lose his salvation. And we have to, as Christians, understand that God the judge coming to condemn us, that has been taken away because Christ paid the penalty for my sins. I deserve death. Christ took it for me. I no longer fear death. I no longer fear being condemned by God the judge because Christ paid that penalty and it's taken off the table. But I still will appear before God and he will look at my life and say, Rob, how did you do? And I'm going to reward you if you did well. And you will not be rewarded, and you might even be punished if you do poorly. And I do that with my kids. When my kids do poorly, they're corrected, they're punished, but they are not cast out of my home. When my kids do well, they're rewarded and they're praised, but they don't become any more my kids than they were before. We have to understand the difference between consequences for our actions, good or bad, and condemnation. We will no longer be condemned, but I will still stand before God the judge, and we will talk about my conduct as his son. It's kind of like this. When I was practicing law, I came out of law school, and I was working in the northern part of the state, and I would appear before these judges, different judges in different counties. And as a young lawyer, I didn't know much about being a lawyer, and so I was learning as I went. And there were two judges in particular who I would go and appear before these judges, Judge Kelsey in Sawyer County and Judge Fox in Price County. And early on in my career as a lawyer, I would be in front of these judges for a hearing or a trial or something. And I'm the attorney. I am not accused of anything. In this courtroom, there is no fear of me being condemned because I'm not on trial. And I would do my thing. And I didn't have to fear, you know what, if I screw up, they're going to throw me in jail or something. That wasn't part of it. I was filling a role. I was serving. And in a sense, I was serving with this judge. Okay, we're trying to come to the truth. And so I would do my thing. And so afterward, the judge would say this, you know, guilty or not guilty, or you owe this money or you owe that. He would make his decision. But those two judges in particular, then, when we're all done, they would say, hey, come here. And they would take me back into their chamber. And that was an incredibly fearful thing for a young lawyer, for the judge to look at you and say, come here. And you walk back there and you don't know what's coming. And they would critique me or correct me or praise me. You did this well, but you really screwed this up. Judge Kelsey used to go through my documents with me. Okay, you did this wrong. You did this wrong. You have to do this. You can't do it this way. You have to do it this way. And I would nod and say, okay. Judge Fox would talk to me about my appearance. You need to look a certain way. You need to conduct yourself a certain way in my courtroom, and you didn't do it today, and that's not okay. And that's kind of what we're talking about. I would stand in front of these judges, not to be condemned. I wasn't on trial. But after it was all done, they would bring me back and they would correct me if I needed it. They would praise me if I had that coming. Does that make sense? You and I will appear before God our judge, not because we're on trial. That is done. But because we are serving with him and he will critique us. And he will praise us or punish us depending on our activity. You and I, God's people, will stand before God the judge to answer how you lived your life, whether good or bad. You will do it. I will do it. not to be condemned, but to be praised or corrected, to be punished or rewarded. And that is still, folks, a fearful thing. Because just like those judges, they didn't care a whole lot about my feelings. And they knew it was fearful to me, and they called me back there anyhow. Your king, your master, your father will call you back to his chambers, and he will speak to you clearly. There will be no secrets, and it will be fearful, and you will talk about the life you lived, how you conducted yourself in this body. And that is the God we worship. That is the God we worship. It's easy to worship a gentle and loving father, isn't it? It's easy to worship him. And God is that. And that part of God's nature deserves worship just as much as any other part. But we need to learn, as his people, to worship God as a gentle and loving father, but also learn to worship him when he is a fearful judge. It's easy to worship the gentle, loving Father. God calls us to worship him then, but also to worship the fearful and powerful judge. That's what we're going to talk about for the next 2 weeks. What does that look like? It's not that God is, you know, one for a while and the other one. He's both at the same time. He is our gentle, loving Father, but he is our fearful and powerful judge. How do I learn to worship both of those aspects of God? And we're focusing in on the fearful and powerful part. That's what this psalm talks about. How do we worship that God? That's what we're going to talk about for the next 2 weeks. What does that look like? And it's, I think, the last thing I want to say is this. That's not a bad thing. It is a good thing to worship that God. It is a right thing to worship that God. It is a joyful, honorable thing to worship that God. In the midst of the fear and the power, to worship him is good and right and a benefit and a blessing and an honor. And you and I are better off for doing it. And I'm going to call the band up here and they're going to get ready. And what I'm going to do is just read some verses to you. I'm not going to comment on these verses at all. I'm just going to read them. And I want you to think about this. Listen as I read these verses, how often you see the juxtaposition between fear and joy, between God the judge and God the Father, and our response to both. Okay? And in this next week, I would encourage you to think about, Lord, do I worship you when you're a gentle, loving Father? And do I worship you when you're a powerful, fearful judge? As I read these verses, you might just want to close your eyes. You can look, I've got them up here. You can look at these if you want. But I'm going to read these verses and I'm going to pray and we're going to be done. Psalm 2, verses 10 and 11. Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Psalm 30, verses 4 and 5. Sing to the Lord, you saints of his. Praise his holy name. For his anger lasts only a moment, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping may remain for the night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. Psalm 51, 17. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. Psalm 76, 10, surely your wrath against men brings you praise, and the survivors of your wrath are restrained. Psalm 89, 15 and 16, blessed are those who have learned to acclaim you, who walk in the light of your presence, O Lord. They rejoice in your name all day long. They exult in your righteousness. Psalm 147, 11, his pleasure is not in the strength of the horse, nor his delight in the legs of man. The Lord delights in those who fear him, who put their hope in his unfailing love. Isaiah 66, 2. This is the one I esteem, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word. Father, thank you that you are both to us. You are a gentle, loving Father, but you are a fearful and powerful judge, and it is good that you are both. We need both. We long for both. Teach us, Lord, to worship you in both aspects. Make us men and women who worship you practically as we live our lives. Help us to do it, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.